And we welcome to our town Sheriff Byron Trapp. He is the sheriff of Lane County, and good to have you here today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Let's just kind of start with some interesting background, I guess, a little bit about the sheriff's office and how the sheriff's office is different from other entities, other law enforcement entities in the state. So what makes you guys different? I know the jail is one thing, but what are some of the others?
So the sheriff is required under the Oregon Constitution, each county to have a sheriff. And so with that, statutes have created specific obligations of the Office of Sheriff that don't exist with any other police agency in the state of Oregon. And that includes a number of things like the county jail. Sheriff's offices are the sheriff of each county is required to receive all those arrested for crimes in the county by any law enforcement and to hold them in custody and to present them to the court. So that requires a jail and then our inmate transport system that goes with that. It requires us to have law enforcement police protection, and that comes under the term called where the statute says that the sheriff is to arrest and commit to prison all persons who break the peace or attempt to break it, which really is a police function. We're required to serve civil process, respond to any needs of the court, and serve all orders of the court. So everything from divorce papers, child custody papers, protective orders, subpoenas for civil cases and criminal cases, any kind of a judgment, small claims, court-ordered sales of real property for foreclosures where somebody sues somebody for non-payment of mortgage or whether it's a tax foreclosure. So there's a lot of activity that happens
through
our civil process, right? So here's a question I get asked often, too. It's like, man, I didn't know you had so much property. You must have a ton of property because my name as the sheriff appears in property sales in our newspapers every day. And so I've had a number of people that have been astonished at the fact that they have an elected sheriff who's also a land baron. Well, I don't own a lot of properties. I am just like most other people. But my name appears on a lot of sales in the newspaper. Those are sales ordered by the courts as part of our sheriff real property sales. We also have to attend to the courts, any state court in our county. And so in Lane, we only have the Lane County Circuit Court. But there's Oregon Court of Appeals and Oregon Supreme Court. And so it's the sheriff's duty to respond to and attend to the needs of the court as the presiding judge's request. We are also have an obligation to provide search and rescue. The sheriff of each county by statute is responsible for all search and rescue operations to occur in the county. And Lane County has a very active search and rescue program, a very demanding community as far as the type of recreation and the variety of recreation we have. So we have one of the most active search and rescue programs in the state. Emergency management is actually not a statutory function of the sheriff. The county is required to provide an emergency management function. And Lane County, through its policies, has assigned the functions of emergency management to the Office of Sheriff. And so our office then is the emergency management function of Lane County, but at a county rule.
So did that come into play when we had the earthquake, up there in Alaska, and it turned out to be a non-entity after all. But
yeah.
Did you guys get a lot of
we had a 3 or 4 a.m. Conference call. Myself, our emergency manager, Linda Cook, who works for the sheriff's office, works in our office. Linda Cook and the Florence police chief, Tom Turner. And the three of us were on a phone conference at 3 to 4 in the morning, looking at the data that was being put out by the National Weather Service, looking at what the forecasts were, all got on our computers at home and looked at the maps, the inundation maps for tsunami and the distant tsunami inundation, and tried to make some educated decisions about what to do. Ultimately, by the time we had finished our early morning conversation, the reports back came that there was no anticipated impacts. And so the decision was then at that point easy to say we didn't need to put out any kind of a community warning. So,
and I think that's interesting too, because here in the morning when I got here, it had already been downgraded, mm-hmm. and people were going like, "Well, why didn't we get a warning? Why didn't?" It's like, well, because there was no warning to give.
There wasn't.
And no sense freaking everybody out at 3 o'clock in the morning, having everybody head down 126. You know, when nothing's going to happen.
Right. And, you know, kicking off those sirens are mostly to clear people off the beaches and to grab people's attention. And there really isn't beach activity at the distant tsunami level. The inundation is fairly limited, and it really would be a beach impact in most cases. So there was a lot of pieces of the conversation that we were evaluating, trying to figure out. But, yeah, that's something that our emergency management program is engaged in, monitors those, gets those early alerts, and then collects those decision makers necessary to make a decision on whether to act, whether to initiate some kind of an alert or a warning, and evaluate how to continue through those whatever kind of natural disaster event it may be.
Based on the community response, and I'm assuming that you guys got some from your end too, do you think it'd do it any different if it were a similar situation again?
No, I mean, the timing really didn't allow us to do a lot different. We were just starting to really delve into trying to make a decision on where and how to send out an alert, if to send out an alert, when we got the notification that it's all had been downgraded and there was no more concern to alert people to. So it really was a quick – that's the thing that I think sometimes is hard to see from the outside looking in, is that by the time you assemble those people you need to confer with and have that conversation, sometimes there's not even time for that. And things happen very quickly.
Of course, you had a good distance from the actual earthquake so that you knew time-wise it would be several hours. It wasn't like several minutes you had to make that
right.
decision.
Yeah, they had a specific time frame. I think it was like 5 or 5:30 that something was supposed to hit, if it was. Mm-hmm. And then they have sensors and ability to track and see if there is wave
on the
activity.
Beach.
Yeah, apparently one that's broken loose from its tie down somewhere. So
I kind of got you off track.
No, that's
there,
right. So really, there's just a couple things left. Concealed handgun licensing. The sheriff of each county is required to issue concealed handgun licenses to those that apply. And Oregon is a shall issue state. So if a person comes to our office and submits the appropriate paperwork application for a concealed handgun license, if they meet all the statutory requirements to obtain the license, the sheriff shall issue that license. So in days of old, it used to be a may issue. The sheriff may issue a CHL to any person that the sheriff believed was of good moral character, which lended to, you know, I really don't like you that much, so I'm not going to give you one, but I really like that person, so I'm going to give them one. And so those kinds of concerns moved Oregon statutorily to a shall issue, or takes the discretion away. And now if you meet the rules, you get a license. If you don't meet the rules, you don't get a license. If you become ineligible by criminal activity or other event in your life that changes your eligibility, then we'll revoke it.
So I imagine that because of your position mm-hmm. and being an elected official, you can't really have an opinion. If I were to ask you an opinion question regarding how you feel about people carrying guns concealed or not, is that?
No, I think it's actually kind of the reverse. Elected officials safely can, well, politically safely is a different discussion,
but
there's no violation of a rule or a protocol about expressing an opinion. In the sheriff's office, we reserve opinions about things that have some political tone to them. They're reserved for the sheriff's opinion, and we encourage our staff to not engage in opinion-based conversations when it comes to our duties of the office. So,
okay. So I won't ask you about that then, but I was just curious as to, you know, I mean, you know, a lot of people walking around with, you know, a gun in their waist, and it's their right. And I agree with that. And, you know, I don't have a problem with that at all. I just was curious as to if it becomes a problem for law enforcement at some point.
You know, it really doesn't. I've been doing this next month. Well, today's still January. So in March, 30 years. And, I have really not experienced, but maybe, and not even directly, I've heard of maybe two or three events that are troubling with a concealed license holder. 99% or more, way more than that, present no problem whatsoever. And I am very supportive of people carrying a firearm if they choose to. I think most law enforcement recognizes that people that have been issued a concealed handgun license have clearly shown that they are legally appropriately in possession of those handguns, and more times than not are supportive of law enforcement and provide a resource out there that might not otherwise exist. So law enforcement, by and large, I really have not seen or heard of any negative response to concealed license holders. Mm-hmm. We do expect them to be appropriate in their conduct. I don't want people to hear this and say, oh, they want me to pull my gun out and come running to help them if I see them on the side of the road somewhere. Don't do that.
And on the sheriff's list, we have one thing left there in the courthouse responsibilities.
Well, that's more of a very limited obligation to that. It says the sheriff shall, the last statutory thing that I could find on the obligations of the sheriff is that the sheriff shall maintain an office in the courthouse or in the building where the courts are held, where court is held. So, and you'll see all county courthouses or county court facilities will have some kind of an office for the sheriff, of some kind of an operational office. Usually it's going to be inmate transport, court security type of a function at a minimum. Mm-hmm. And then in our case in Lane County, all of our operations essentially are based out of the courthouse except our jail. So all of our police operations, our administrative operations, civil dispatch, investigations, a records office, all those things are our entire operation of who we are outside of jail operations is in our courthouse.
So it's just been a few months enacted now, but the new texting law, do you guys have much to do with that while you're on the roads? And
We don't, only from this perspective, and this can potentially open up a whole nother conversation, but our office, our deputies do very little traffic enforcement today, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. We have been downsized over the last decade by budget reductions, and our police operations have been cut substantially. And so we used to have a very active and engaged traffic enforcement program, traffic safety team. And they would target the driving behaviors that were most closely connected with fatal and serious injury accidents, speed, following too close, impaired driving, and aggressive driving. And texting certainly falls into that. Distracted driving component is a very high contributor to crash events. So in the last 5 years of our traffic team, it was closed in 2010 as we downsized and cut staffing. But in the last 5 years, our traffic team active, all sheriff's office citation volume averaged about 25,000 citations a year to the local court. Most of that was justice court. And I haven't obtained the numbers for 17, but in 2016, we didn't write 3,000 tickets countywide.
So and 22,000 so, different.
Yeah, so it's a more than 88% reduction in traffic safety enforcement. Mm-hmm. And we have seen our fatality rate in Lane County skyrocket. In 2015, our fatalities, number of total lives lost just on Lane County roads, with all road systems within Lane County, including cities, 57 people died. And we would hover historically in the 30s. And so 57 is huge increases. And ODOT's numbers are usually a couple years behind, so we should see the 16 numbers come out very soon. I'm hopeful they're not as high as they were in 15, but that's a direct reflection, in my opinion, of the lack of traffic enforcement. People can drive nearly any way they choose to with very little to no risk of consequence in Lane County.
It's Oregon very, State. Very rare if you're coming from Eugene to here. Every now and then you'll see a sheriff's deputy on the road. But
we passed one this morning on our way over. Mm-hmm. He was pulled over on the side of the road, probably on a phone call. But, yeah, it's very rare. I've heard it said that our deputies are very much like Sasquatch. People hear about them. They know they're out there, but you rarely see them. So, unfortunately, that's very true. And other than that one deputy parked on the side of the road. He wasn't even active. He wasn't in a position to do traffic enforcement, I don't think. I don't know that we saw a trooper on the way over either. So it's not uncommon that we'll get a report of a drunk driver, impaired driver, and they'll be home safe in bed before we can get somebody out there to intercept them. And so, unfortunately, if people can get home safely without causing a crash, we rarely have interactions with driving behavior concerns. So,
of course, it would be better if they didn't drink and drive.
Folks. Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, and that is certainly a huge contributor to serious injuries and fatalities on our highways is impaired driving. And so,
well, you got safe driving. You get the self-driving cars coming soon. So maybe
we'll see. Yeah. So anyway, all that to say that our office has very little traffic safety activity just because our deputies don't have the discretionary time that is necessary to do traffic enforcement. They respond pretty much from radio call to radio call of active in progress events. And there's just not time in between where they can actively engage in discretionary enforcement. So
unless,
it's responsive.
I'm guessing unless it's something glaring that they witness while they're
yes.
driving.
And so if there's something that they drive up behind and see somebody driving in a certain manner then and they need to take action, they can. And if they're not responding to an emergency that has higher priority to that. So that's where we're down to our very limited level of enforcement reflects that we just don't have the deputy resources out there any longer to give that focused attention. So all that to say, the distracted driving amended rules on cell phones is not a high priority for us at this point just because of our resource level. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that our deputies have written a few violation citations for that. And I expect them to if they see that and they have the opportunity to make that traffic stop to do those enforcement efforts as they have the time and capacity to do.
How involved are you guys in like the marijuana legislation enforcement mm-hmm. of that and what actually has happened with that? Because I mean, you know, yes, it's legal here, mm-hmm. but you still hear about, oh, you know, somebody transported a heavy volume of marijuana right. over the line. So there's still black
right.
market stuff going on in that.
Yeah.
Are you involved much in that?
At a limited level, and I would just to clarify that, I hear people say all the time, it's legal in Oregon. It's not, actually.
Oh, okay.
It's not legal anywhere.
Well, that's true.
Because it's federal law. It's still a federal law violation.
Yeah.
And so marijuana in any amount is not legal anywhere in the United States. It's no longer a violation of Oregon law,
right.
but it's not legal. And so, you know, that's the first thing I think people misunderstand you are still putting yourself at risk for federal penalty should that occasion arise, and it doesn't very often. But you know, we did see a oil lab explosion in Cottage Grove that federal law enforcement has taken that case on, and I expect to see some prosecution from that. So the federal government is still involved in investigation of marijuana cultivation. But at the local level, we, again, because of our limited resource, we don't put a lot of focus on that. We don't have a county drug team anymore. They were providing some focus to that. But we will try to, if we get complaints of a marijuana growing operation and it appears to be clearly outside of the rules that are provided under Oregon law, we will certainly try to find a way to make contact and to ensure that they are compliant. So there's a set of rules and guidelines under Oregon's medical marijuana program. There are obviously new rules and guidelines that apply to the non-medical, what they call recreational, but essentially the non-medical part of Oregon's marijuana program now. And so the non-medical is enforced by OLCC. So if a person is going to grow marijuana in the non-medical category, their approval for that goes through the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And then any violations of that are the exclusive control and investigation of OLCC. And if a person is operating under Oregon's medical marijuana program, then those rules are overseen and enforced by the Oregon Health Department. And so if a person is in possession of growing, cultivating, and manufacturing marijuana products outside of either of those two categories, they're not registered with OLCC and they're not registered with the medical program, then it falls to general law enforcement. And so if we get a report, the first thing we do is find out if they're registered with OLCC, then we refer them to OLCC. If they're part of the medical program, then we don't take action there because we don't have the authority to pursue anything if it's medical. And if they're not registered with either one of those and it appears that they're in violation of Oregon law, then we'll try to have a deputy make contact and see if we can educate them into compliance. And in some occasion, we'll take enforcement action as necessary.
I had a few other little topics here, but basically I think they fall under the same thing you were talking about as far as, you know, decreased manpower because of, you know, things kind of becoming more condensed with you guys. So I don't know that we can go on that, but
sure.
we do have the jail levy that we can talk about. I noticed that, you know, the increase over the last couple of years in beds, amount of beds available. Is that a good thing? Is that something to be proud of or something to be, you know, looked down upon? Because, I mean, it just seems like, are we locking more people up? Or?
So here's my perspective. I think it's something we should be very proud of as a community. We had decimated the sheriff's office service levels in all categories to include the jail. Between 2007 and 2012, the sheriff's office laid off 95 employees. Many of those deputy sheriffs, we actually helped many of those young men and women get jobs in other communities. And unfortunately, none of them came back as we began to rehire deputies in our restoring of services. But we had reduced our patrol services kind of where we left it there. We really haven't been able to build that back. We've talked about a little bit of that, the impacts to community on traffic safety and other investigative limitations. But also as important was the jail was nearly closed. We were down to 125 available beds for local offenders. And so to put that in perspective, Oregon average for sheriff's offices across the state for our size and our crime rate, population level and all that, we should have about 600 local jail beds. Well, our jail is only a 500-bed jail. So we'd have to build jail capacity in addition to what we have to be even Oregon average. If you look at a national average, that average assessment says that we should be 1,100 beds, which to me is beyond kind of the crazy zone. We'll never get there. And probably I don't know that we need to be there.
Well, I mean, there's also some cultural differences.
There is.
Some high crime differences in certain areas that, you know, bring that average up, I'm sure.
Yes. And so that's kind of the perspective maybe where we should be is probably close to the 600 mark. So we're probably about halfway there. But what really was most telling of the serious public safety risk that we were presenting was in 2012, the year before the levy passed, we were releasing for the previous years to that. We had been releasing Measure 11 violent offenders in violation of state law. We were releasing other non-Measure 11 but still considered violent offenders in violation of state law. And people are like, well, what's that mean? Well, Measure 11 is the rape, murder, robbery, arson, the very, very violent, harmful crimes in our community. And in 2012, we released three people pending homicide charges from our jail because of capacity. Two of them were drunk drivers that had killed somebody while they were out driving drunk because there's no resource to keep drunk drivers off our road. And so we didn't have jail capacity to keep those people in our jail before they went to trial. And while that's not a violent murder, it's still a homicide. And they still took somebody out of our community that is never going to go home to their family. And they should be held accountable, not at home having another beer on the couch while they're waiting for trial.
Right.
I don't know that they did that. But they could have, and they shouldn't have had that opportunity. The third case actually was fairly violent. A couple of guys, lifelong buddies from the Oak Ridge area, decided to go fishing camping up at Hills Creek. While setting up camp, got in some kind of a argument. They were very intoxicated. One guy beat his buddy to death with a piece of firewood. And he was released before we could keep him through trial. He was ultimately, I believe, convicted of manslaughter and sent to state prison. So we were able to get him through the court system, but not while holding him in our jail.
Right.
So post-levy, once the community recognized there was a serious need for increasing our jail bed capacity, the community passed the jail levy in 2013, May of 2013, and we were immediately able to double the jail beds, more than double them, from 125 to 256. And that was on July 1, 13. From that day forward, we have not released Measure 11 offenders or violent felony offenders pre-trial or from a sentence before completed. if they're serving that in the county jail. And so the immediate impact was tremendous as far as violent offenders. We have also been able to work at curbing our rate of release from the jail due to capacity. And over the course of the last 5 years, we have incrementally increased jail capacity as we have added new staff. So we've been working very diligently for 5 years to hire more deputies and more support staff to operate more of the jail using the levy revenues. And so as of February 3, coming up here in a couple days,
this will air after February 3.
Oh, will?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we'll just say,
as of February 3. Okay. So, yeah. So effective February 3, as of today or as of now, we have 367 beds available for local offenders. So that equates to a 293% increase in jail capacity after the levy had passed. And one of the important things to note is kind of back to your question, are we just warehousing people? So we're still releasing people early. We have not grown past our capacity-based release issue. But what
just nonviolent.
Yes. And so the very good thing that we see today with our jail capacity is while we haven't fixed our capacity issues, and I don't expect we will in the near future, but we have moved past the violent offender releases, and those people that are released from jail today are being released from charges that are nonviolent. We kind of refer to them often as quality of life crime or nuisance crime. So they might be petty theft, shoplifting, drug crime, even felony possession or felony drug crime, but they're nonviolent types of crimes. And so those numbers are much lower. We're working at trying to reduce all levels of that, but the violent felony offenders are staying in jail through trial, through conviction, and then being processed to state prison if it's a felony conviction in most cases. So that as long as we have capacity-based release, I think there's an argument there that we haven't built too much jail. But the other thing that's very important to know is that as we have built the jail back, and as we have increased jail capacity, we're not simply building a jail warehouse, human warehouse space. We have been very conscious with a direct effort, a focused effort to build into the jail capacity, the jail system, a treatment-based programs. And so we, in cooperation with sponsors, a reentry program in the community, have engaged in, and with Parole and Probation and managing their clients, and with Lane County Behavioral Health, have engaged in a number of programs where we provide adult-based education, GED completion for those in the jail. Many of them continue in that program after their release from jail. We have drug and alcohol treatment. We have cognitive behavioral therapy training and treatment that occurs in the jail, and that program continues when they go to sponsors reentry, and many people that get released from jail will continue to go, even if they're not part of sponsors programs, will continue that training and try to get their completion certificate. And then mental health is a huge issue for us in the county jail. Over 60% or right at 60% of our population in the county jail has some kind of a mental health issue. And so we have, in coordination with our medical provider that we contract to provide medical services to our inmates in our jail, we have enhanced that contract to increase mental health capacity. We have actually just recently, they have hired a full-time psychologist that's on staff full-time in the county jail. In addition to that enhanced staffing and resource on the contract medical program, we have, in coordination with Lane County's behavioral health team, we have hired 3 behavioral health clinicians who work inside the jail also, in addition to our medical provider. Their focus is a little different. They're more of a trying to identify a release discharge plan. As soon as an inmate books in and they identify mental health concerns or needs with that inmate, they begin a discharge plan process so that as that person becomes eligible for release, that we just don't open the jail door and let them out and wish them good luck. That we actually try to directly connect them to, transport them to, or otherwise engage in a direct handoff to a service provider to address their issues. Ideally, if they come in unhoused, we try to find housing opportunities for them when they get released. And wow. And then at the same time, while they're in jail, this team of three behavioral health workers are able to be a family liaison. We've had a number of cases where I've been called directly by mothers of young men that are in our jail. And I mean, it's unsettling, I think, any time a mother finds her son in a county jail. But when your son suffers a mental health concern, some kind of a mental health diagnosis, there's a heightened concern. And so this gives family members a very targeted place to go to learn about their family members' health concerns and health needs in the jail. We then also learn from the family exactly what this person needs as far as considerations and special circumstances that we may be able to provide in the jail that we wouldn't have known otherwise. So
not always bad people, just sometimes bad circumstances.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right, yeah.
Do you have any numbers or any sense of a reduction in the recidivism rate because of this, or is it too soon yet?
You know, I think it's too soon.
But you're doing all the right steps.
We're trying to. I think we are actually appear to be, you know, on the leading edge in the state. Other county jail managers have commented to our jail management staff that that seems to be the case. And I think we really, when I became sheriff and I realized we had this need for mental health services in our jail, I was a little irritated by it, I guess, to be candid. I thought that's not my job. My job is to hold people accountable for the criminal behavior that they've engaged in our community. And I'm not a medical facility. I'm not a mental health treatment program. But then as I really spent some more time thinking through the issue, it really is my problem. It is our problem as a community. And until there are sufficient mental health programs and support systems in our community, this will be a burden carried by the taxpayer through their jails. And so it's not only, you know, something we have to do, but it is the right thing to do. And so it is a piece that we have to look at from some compassion and recognition that we're dealing with humans and we're dealing with people that in many cases are in crisis when they come to us. It's unfortunate that we don't have those external behavioral health systems out there to prevent people from coming to jail, because many of these folks that come to jail, at least early on in their first few criminal charges, sometimes a mental health crisis is the reason they have their first criminal justice introduction. Mm-hmm. And our deputies, I'm not blaming other law enforcement, our deputies are in the same problem, that we engage with somebody in crisis in the community. We have no family members to contact that are willing to intercede and give some support and aid. There are no mental health services we can deliver them to. And if they're too violent in their behavior, some of the emergency shelters aren't willing to take right. these people. And so the police officers, troopers, and deputies kind of look around. They go, well, he is blocking traffic on the road. That is disorderly conduct. I guess we go to the jail. And they take somebody that's never been arrested in their life. They're suffering from sometimes a severe and persistent mental illness, maybe coupled with some kind of drug and alcohol abuse issue and addiction, and they introduce them to the jail. Now, we're not necessarily helping resolve what got them there, but we're adding to their problems. Now they have a criminal record, and now if they're having housing concerns, it's even harder for them to find housing because now they have a criminal charge. So it's a complicated mess. It really is. And from a selfish perspective, I'd love to see us take that 60% of our population and give them the effective treatment and care outside of the jail to free up jail capacity for those that choose to commit crimes that really should be in the jail. And I'm not saying somebody that's diagnosed or that has mental health issues shouldn't be in the jail. There are some that absolutely need to be in the jail. But there are, I think, a fair number that should never have been introduced to the jail, but we don't have any way to divert them in this community. And this isn't Lane County's problem. This is the national average is 60-70%. Of jail prison inmates have a mental health issue. And Oregon reflects that. Just a few years back, it was 30%. So it's an increasing problem. It's a challenge that all jails, law enforcement is dealing with.
Well, and a lot of that's come down to the fact that a lot of the mental health insurance benefits and that have gone away in the last 10 years. So therefore, no one's treating these folks.
Yeah, I'm not educated enough to know all the causes behind the lack. But I know it started when we deinstitutionalized mostly statewide health, behavioral health care. And, you know, if you look back in the days when we had the large state mental hospitals, they probably needed to be closed down. There were abuses and there was neglect. There were a lot of reasons that those institutions needed to be reformed, if not eliminated. Mm-hmm. The problem was, I think we took away those institutions with the promise of local-based behavioral health and mental health support, and that local level never materialized. It not to the level that it took the need of what was displaced from the state level. So we're suffering through that now. And so we have people that if they can maintain stably at home with family members as their caregivers, that works most of the time. But if they go into crisis, there's not a support system there to fill in. And then we deal with very chaotic events where a person suffering a mental illness will become violent in a crisis in the home, and those caregivers become their victims. And then they can't go back home once they get out of jail. So then it's just complicated. And then there's housing issues and all kinds of stuff. And not uncommon, you know, the mental health is coupled with addiction. And that's kind of a multi-level treatment and very complicated. So like I said, I'm not educated enough on the outside in the treatment world to know exactly what needs to be done to make sure that none of these people come to jail that should otherwise be diverted. But we are committed to being a community partner and supporting all those efforts. We're very engaged in providing dedicated jail capacity for specific treatment programs, whether it's treatment courts, drug treatment court, veterans treatment court, mental health treatment court, all through the Lane County Circuit Court system, very strong partnerships with parole and probation and with treatment programs through sponsors. All these things focused on trying to do as much as we can do internally, at the same time appropriately manage and mitigate the mental health impacts. It makes the jail safer for the inmates that are in our jail when we are more effectively managing their mental health needs, and it makes the jail safer for our deputies and support staff that work in the jail. So it's there's no reason not to do it, but it is a challenge to meet. So all of that, to answer your question, is that I think, yes, it's a very good thing that we have been able to enhance our jail capacity, and we're at a level today that is providing a safety margin that didn't exist 5 years ago. And I'm very pleased that the community seems to recognize and appreciate that. The renewal vote last May, almost a year ago, at 73% was really astounding, the amount of support we have from the community. And I think that's partly because we've been able to show that there was a serious need and that we have been very good stewards of the monies given to us. The audit that was reported out yesterday, audit was reported out this week that it's the fourth audit annual. One of the requirements of the ballot measure that was passed originally in 2013 and then again this last May in 17 requires that there's an annual audit to prove that the funds have been managed as the voters demanded, that they were kept not commingled from county funds but kept in an individual identified account, that we could identify exactly where those funds go, that those funds were used exclusively for jail beds and youth service programs, and that they weren't spent on any other programs in the county, that there was sufficient general fund provided to our budget to allow for the enhancement of the jail that we see. And then the audit then says all those things happen. So it's a fourth audit in 4 years that says that everything that the voters agreed to on the ballot that allowed us to have the revenue to run the jail is being done, and we're committed to continuing to do that. I think the other thing worth noting, actually, on the jail levy is that we're in the second budget year where we're using less revenue from the levy than the voters authorized the county to levy. The vote.
So does that go down to efficiency then?
It's a couple things. One is that we haven't, because it took us a long time, we're still working at hiring staff to get up to speed. we didn't spend the revenue as fast as we thought we would. So our initial first 2 or 3 years, our expenses were way lower than we had anticipated. We kind of built the budget thinking that in a very short order we'd hire 100 deputies and we'd get up and running. Well, we're not there, and we're still not there. We're close. And so our expenses are now much higher than they were in the first couple years. But that first couple years, the county levied the full 55 cents, and that built a reserve because we underspent it. And so as I looked at this reserve growing and pushing $30 million, realized quickly that there's no reason for us to collect that revenue if we're not able to spend it. So as we processed budget through the budget committee, we requested that they levy only 38 cents for the last 2 years to allow us to spend that reserve down as we ramped up our expense. And so each year we're committed to really evaluating exactly how much money needs to be levied to cover the expenses. And then we'll request for the budget committee and the commissioners, when they pass the budget, actually levy just the amount that's necessary each year to cover the expenses and not more, and to make sure that we're only receiving the amount of money necessary to pay for the service that the community asked us to provide, and that we're not just maximizing our revenue just because we can. And so we'll see. This budget year, we're just beginning the budget process, and one of the primary issues we'll be looking at as we build the jail budget is exactly how much revenue do we need? Does that need to stay at 38 cents? Should it come up? I anticipate this year it'll probably come up a little bit. I really don't think it's going to come close to 55 cents this year. That gives us room for a couple more years where we can grow into this, and we don't anticipate having to ask the voters to increase the levy immediately.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, that's a lot of great information, and I'm definitely more educated now about Lane County Sheriff's Office than I was before, and we appreciate you stopping by today and spending some time with us.
Absolutely. I appreciate the invite. It's good to be here.
All right. Sheriff Byron Trapp, everybody, Lane County Sheriff's Office. And, oh, when do you re-up? When's your—
So I'm starting my second year of my first term, so three more years of the term. My term started January of 17. Yeah. So that's a year ago.
All right. So you got time then. Yeah. Well, we'll discuss that at another day.
Right.
All right. Thank you so much.
You bet. Take care.
And that's it for our February edition of Our Town. Tune in the first Wednesday of every month for Our Town here on Coast Radio.